Hi, I'm Jose Maria Macedu, a partner at Delphi Digital. I'll be co-hosting episodes of the Delphi podcast with a broad focus on economics, governance, and incentives. With our guests, I'll explore different, sometimes radical, economic perspectives and how these affect what we value as a society and how we organize ourselves to achieve it. Ultimately, my goal with these conversations is to expand our perspectives in ways that allow us to build better systems going forward. As a reminder, nothing said on this podcast is a solicitation to buy or sell any security or token or to make any financial decisions. I or Delphi Ventures may hold tokens mentioned on this podcast, and you can see our show notes for a full disclaimer. First, a quick word from our sponsors before we dive in.
Hey, everyone. I wanted to tell you about our new podcast sponsor, LVL. LVL is releasing the first free Bitcoin exchange in North America. The LVL mobile app allows you to buy and sell Bitcoin with no trading fees or hidden spreads. With LVL, you get free Bitcoin trading, a hosted Bitcoin wallet, an FDIC-insured personal checking account, wires, checks, and direct deposits, and even a MasterCard debit card. If you use their premium account for $9 a month, you get autopilot automatic trading, chat with a dedicated private banker, and even a metal MasterCard. Check them out at lvl.co or check them out in the show notes below. Now back to our show.
Today I'm joined by Aaron Wright. Aaron is a professor at Cardozo Law School in New York City and the co-founder of Open Law, The Lao, and Flamingo DAO. He's also one of the most knowledgeable and eloquent people I've spoken to on the subject of DAOs. Aaron, thanks very much for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks so much, Jose, for having me on the podcast. It's really great to be here. My name is Aaron Wright. I'm the co-founder of a project called Open Law. I have a background in law and technology. Before starting Open Law, I had the pleasure of selling a company to the for-profit sister project, Wikipedia, called Wikia, and helped to grow that to be one of the largest sites online. I'm also a lawyer by training and currently a law professor at Cardozo Law School in New York. I fell down the Bitcoin rabbit hole pretty early in 2011. I'm deeply interested in open source technology from my time at Wikia and Wikipedia. Was also an economics major and history major in college. So Bitcoin kind of hit me in lots of my sweet spots. And really when Ethereum was launched, I just joined the faculty at Cardozo. I thought it was an incredibly interesting project. Had the pleasure of working closely with the folks that were pulling together Ethereum and played a small role helping to launch it. From that time, I really think about lots of the legal issues and also technical issues that would emerge with blockchain technology. Put together an organization with Vitalik Buterin and also Kieran Lubin called the Cryptocurrency Research Group, and began to work on a book, what turned into a book, thinking about the hard problems in what we called crypto law. That manifested into a full book that was published by Harvard University Press in 2018. And kind of one core aspect of the book was thinking about what this would do to commercial systems and contracting. And what we wrote about was this notion of a Ricardian contract and what that may look like. And really the fruits of that labor is a project called Open Law, which is enabling folks to put together contracts that are digital in nature. So instead of being written down on paper, they're turned into data objects that you can read information from, you can write information to. And importantly, for the Ethereum ecosystem, you're able to trigger a whole bunch of different smart contracts once an agreement is signed. So we kind of marry together the traditional world and the crypto world. This may be kind of an intermediate step, but we think an important one over the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years.
That's awesome. Yeah, I mean, I definitely want to get deeper into Open Law and also the work you're doing at the Lao and Flamingo DAO. But I wanted to start at kind of a higher level because you have a really interesting perspective on this stuff and then kind of work our way down. I'm wondering if you can talk a bit about kind of the history of an organization, of what an organization is, and also how these kind of different organizational structures that emerged throughout history, help kind of drive progress, and then, I guess, situate DAOs in that for us.
Yeah, absolutely. since people have formed into societies, I would say pretty advanced societies, we've seen different ways and different organizations that have emerged. If you go back in time and look at the Romans, they had organizations that enabled people to pool capital and limited liability. We saw evolutions of organizations emerge in Europe during the age of exploration with the first state chartered corporations that were used to kind of fund and also funnel any profits that were generated by various different enterprises chartered by the state. When the U.S. started, and shortly thereafter, in 1811, we saw really the birth of the modern corporation, which was huge, right? It meant anybody could set up a business, enjoy limited liability, collect capital, and use that capital to engage in productive commercial enterprises. When we saw the railroad boom in the 1860s to 1880s in the United States, we saw the birth of preferred shares, which enabled different investor classes, which really helped fuel the growth of railroads in the U.S. and also laid the foundation for really what we still do today for things like venture capital financing in Silicon Valley. And as the world globalized in the late 1970s or starting in the late 1970s, and as we began to engage in more international commerce and oil and gas exploration, we saw the birth of the limited liability company in Wyoming, which has kind of taken over big swaths of how different funds and entities are organized today. But I think this is just the beginning. I think the one age that we've entered into where we haven't seen a full organization emerge is the internet. The internet, I think, operates from a different paradigm. It's global in nature. It's not meant to accommodate small groups of people, rather large groups of people. And I think that's why so many folks, particularly folks in the Ethereum ecosystem, have always been interested in this notion of a decentralized autonomous organization or a DAO. And that's something we've been deeply focused on at OpenLaw and a couple of related projects that we've helped pull together, including the WAO and also Flamingo DAO.
That's really cool. And so I guess you see DAOs as kind of the next step in this long history of organizations, of like internet native organizations almost. I guess could you like define how you see a DAO? Because obviously people have different definitions. You know, autonomous kind of implies run by smart contracts, but there's also, but some people say, you know, run just autonomously on the internet. So I guess how do you see what a DAO is, and what's your vision for DAOs long term?
Yeah, and you know, DAOs do have different definitions, and I think we're still figuring that out. The way I like to think about it is that a DAO is kind of a broad category for an organization where some aspect of it is using some form of automation technology. So at its extreme, it would be entirely algorithmic. So an algorithm would control and manage the entire organization, and humans are kind of pushed to the edges. I think outside of arguably Bitcoin and possibly Ethereum, we haven't really seen kind of pure algorithmic-based DAOs yet, although there's good arguments for it. The other kind of category of DAOs is what I call member-managed DAOs or decentralized organizations, which in many ways are trying to keep humans at the center and use democratic processes to thin the need for a centralized group of managers, either a board of directors or formal managers if you're thinking about like a fund structure. So I think those are the two differentiating kind of categories of what we're seeing emerge. These algorithmic DAOs, and then I would say these decentralized organizations that are very, very democratic in nature. And I think we're seeing a lot of interest in the latter because fundamentally Ethereum reduces transaction costs. And there's lots of economic theory related to this, but if you're able to reduce transaction costs, you can start to see less hierarchical organizations emerge. And that those less hierarchical organizations are really interesting. Right. So imagine a world where you have organizations that aren't run by managers. Instead, they're run by the stakeholders or the owners or the workers or those that are part of it. That's hard to do today because it's really hard to assemble information. It's really expensive. It's really difficult to manage internal operations. And what DAOs are beginning to do is just flip that equation, lower the cost. So we're starting to see some organizations that can actually be member managed and can use, for the most part, Ethereum-based smart contracts to automate a lot of the nitty-gritty underlying operational aspects of it, which is really amazing and really fun to watch.
Could you explain what you mean by sort of reduced transaction costs? Because I think a lot of people will hear that and kind of look at Ethereum and see the sort of gas costs right now and have a problem with that. But you mean something slightly different with that, right? Kind of like the coordination costs of transactions or yeah. Could you expand a bit on what you mean there?
It's both. You know, if you're running a corporation today, it's pretty cumbersome to do so. If you're taking an action, you need to memorialize it in a legal document called a board resolution. Various different people need to sign it to make it a formal corporate action. There's a lot of paperwork that goes on behind the scenes. And there's a lot of complex internal accounting controls or other types of controls that need to be put in place to make sure that funds are properly administered. With the DAO, you know, with a few hundred lines of code, you can reduce that. It's easier to do things like online voting if you don't care about some of the privacy aspects of the vote itself. It's also very easy to transfer funds. So if everybody decides to go in a certain direction, you can have recorded evidence of the fact that they voted in one way. And at the same time, you can transfer funds and place important controls around those funds so that you can administer an organization. That's much, much lower cost, even when you include the gas costs that need to be paid, than what we have today for most organizations. And what's also interesting is that it's publicly available and transparent to others. So you can begin to see that activity. People can hold you accountable for that. And there's no additional documents or filings that need to be put together. And even beyond that, since all these DAOs are running on Ethereum, you can start to see really interesting emergent DAO-to-DAO interactions where interactions between different DAOs or different organizations are easier to administer because they're running on the same operating system. So the entire ecosystem of DAOs, I think in the long run, will be much cheaper for folks to organize and operate out of. And I think you're going to start to see really interesting dynamics that emerge between DAOs as we begin to continue to build the tooling and as the cost of doing that goes down.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think we can see that with the LAO and some of the stuff you've worked on. Another aspect we always kind of touch on is the fact that by making organizations kind of open source and digital, you really reduce the iteration cycle in terms of experimenting with new forms of organization, right? And new forms of human coordination. And so what we feel is that will make it much, it'll sort of compound the innovation that's possible and make it possible to have newer types of organization. You know, we're already seeing kind of experiments there with stuff like DAO Stack and holographic consensus and stuff. But I'm curious if you think that's because obviously kind of experimenting with types of organization in the real world is quite difficult. And do you see that as kind of an important part here as well?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I was able to write this book. We thought a lot about the theory behind DAOs in it. There's a great legal scholar, Yochai Benkler, who in general has been up at Harvard, but he wrote a tremendous book called The Wealth of Networks back during the kind of first crest of the internet. And in that, he described notions of peer production for open source ecosystems. And I think DAOs fit squarely in that. One way that we thought about them was as open source organizations where the underlying software is freely available and people can understand and build on top of that. And I think if we continue to see smart contracts develop like other open source ecosystems, you're going to see lower costs in terms of building, but also greater experimentation. So it's really hard to experiment with governance today. But when you see things like what the folks at DAO Stack are doing, or DXDAO is doing, or GnosisDAO is doing, where they're exploring different mechanics to get consensus, to think about how people can participate in organizations. My sense is we may not know all the answers now, and some of these new mechanisms may not fully work yet, but we'll get to a point where we learn something new and are able to kind of deploy that into the wild.
For sure. Yeah, Gitcoin, another great example, you know, by sort of taking the concept of quadratic funding by another podcast guest, Glenn Whale, and kind of implementing that is a pretty cool one. And I'm curious, how do you see the main categories of DAOs? Like, do you think a DAO has to have some form of kind of formal on-chain governance in order to qualify? Or would something like Ethereum, where there's this like rough off-chain like social consensus, also would you also see that as a DAO?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is a big question and a definitional one. So if you think about an algorithmic system that's managing how people interact, you take that broad definition, then something like Bitcoin and Ethereum would qualify there, right? People are interacting with this algorithmic system, the core blockchain software nodes and our smart contracts that are kind of bundled together and instructing people and ordering people's behavior. So I think that that can qualify. I do take kind of that broad definition. I think what we're going to see more of is member-managed DAOs. So DAOs that really use democratic processes to get people's sentiment, opinions. A lot of that will happen off-chain. Even though it does happen off-chain, there's a record on-chain, and you're able to make decisions in a flatter, less hierarchical structure or way.
That's cool. And within those member-managed DAOs, we kind of tend to think about them as two broad camps. Like you have the protocol DAOs, which are kind of managing this underlying public good, setting parameters and managing treasury decisions and stuff like that, like Aave or Synthetics. And then more of the collectives, where it's either a group of people coming together to pool either capital or intellectual capital and organize themselves and allocate those resources. So stuff like the Lao and Meta Cartel on the sort of capital side, and then stuff like Deorg and Raid Guild on like the worker collective side. Do you think that's a useful kind of distinction, or how do you think about it?
I think it's incredibly broad. So I think that anywhere where we see people pulling together funds and administering it, it's open for reinterpretation by DAOs and blockchain technology writ large. So any fund structure, whether or not that's a venture capital fund, a hedge fund, private equity fund, other form of fund that operates, I think that those can be updated and modernized using a DAO infrastructure. I think other types of structures that we may not think of as funds necessarily, but in effect operate in a fund-like way, things like the production of creative works, the production of fashion goods or other merchandise, I think we're going to see those get reinterpreted with DAOs. And same thing for just what you would consider a general business, where people collect funds and provide services in different ways. Organizations are everywhere, right? And there's lots of different ways to structure them. I think DAOs could be applicable in lots of different ways. I guess the last category, what I think you call the protocol DAO, which I would think of it as a DAO just to organize some sort of open source community or ecosystem. So that's obviously going to be a high growth area, particularly as open source technology continues to grow, not just in the blockchain ecosystem, but across the entire technology landscape. So I think it's quite broad. And then I think we may see other organizations that are entirely new. So if people, let's say, continue to break down digital pieces of art into small pieces, how do you manage that? Well, maybe one way that you do that is through a DAO. Since it's so cheap to set these things up, something like that is possible. Or let's say we get to a point in 5 to 10 years where we're able to translate real property, things like land, et cetera, into a digital environment like a blockchain. Well, maybe we could set up a DAO to kind of manage the administration of this more fractionalized piece of land. So I think that we don't fully know where it's going to go, but I do think the fact that the costs of just setting these things up and administering them have gone down, it means that we're going to see more micro organizations. And then I think on the broader side, and lots of folks have written about this, I think you're going to see some very, very large organizations. So putting, and if the regulatory environment permitted it, I don't see why it's not feasible to have DAOs that have, tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people that are interacting and operating in it. And that's large. It may not be the largest organization. Some really, really big international corporations have that many people kind of working with them or in their orbit. But I think we could conceivably get even larger than that.
Yeah, that's a really cool vision. And obviously, I think one of the big questions for DAOs these days as well is sort of the legal side. So how they interact with the traditional legal system. And this is kind of where a lot of the work you do with open law comes in. And I think we're seeing sort of a split amongst DAOs where some of them, either don't have legal entities or have legal entities, but the DAO essentially operates in a self-sovereign way. And then DAOs more like the Lao, which have like legal wrappers effectively associated to them and operate and give up some sovereignty to the traditional legal system effectively. I mean, could you talk a bit about open law, like your goals and why you think that the legal wrappers are so important in kind of pushing the space forward?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, the first great experiment with DAOs was the DAO itself. It was a spectacular disaster, right? Led to a hard fork of Ethereum, led to, you know, certain regulatory responses in the US from the SEC, where they kind of weighed in on tokens for the first time. But the vision, I think, was compelling. This idea that you could build a venture capital fund or something that was like a venture capital fund that ran natively on the internet, that had broad participation, I think was incredibly interesting. And I think that's why we saw it collect so much Ether, which at today's dollars would have been billions and billions of dollars of Ether. But it broke, right? There was technical issues. And at least in the US, we weighed in and found that there was some legal issues. The legal issues weren't just related to the tokens. They were also related to the fact that once the DAO got hacked or robbed and Ether was stolen, who was going to be responsible to make folks whole? So fortunately, the hard fork and the fact that Ether appreciated kind of made this a non-issue. But if you're going to be working together in the US or most of Europe and other parts of the globe, working together with others and trying to make a profit, in many ways, you get, and oftentimes, you're going to get characterized as a partnership. And partnerships create lots of weird liabilities for folks that are interacting in them, whereby one partner may be able to collect assets from another partner if something goes wrong. And that's why we've been interested on the open law side in thinking about how to wrap these limited liability, these DAOs in limited liability companies. And the thought around this really started at the beginning of Ethereum. MIT put together some really amazing programs before and around the time Ethereum launched, just thinking about the space and some of the implications. So me and a professor at Washington and Lee down in Virginia, and Primavera De Filippi, who I had the pleasure of co-authoring a book with, and a whole bunch of other folks, began to think about what it would mean to have DAOs in the wild. And one concept that we explored, was this idea of wrapping a DAO in a limited liability company. And we saw from that kind of Vermont in the US implement a law, the BBLLC law, which enabled folks to set up organizations in Vermont and operate them using smart contract-based systems. And folks like Ross Campbell, who happens to work on the open law team, and the DORG folks began to implement that in practice over the past couple of years. And what we recognized pretty early on was that this is a really nice way to begin to grow out the DAO ecosystem. So it shouldn't be just one-off concepts. We really should build out a framework. And with the tools that we have in open law, we could factory out the creation of these DAOs. And so that's what we started to do with Allow. The concept being, and I think we saw this in earlier iterations of how blockchain technologies developed. We've seen certain projects like Mt. Gox, as an example, that kind of made the model. They kind of made the first exchange model. They innovated there. But we saw other teams like the Coinbase team and the Gemini team and a whole bunch of other exchanges in the US decide that they were going to dot I's and cross T's with US law to build a real business around it. So we think the DAO, in many ways, was like the Mt. Gox of DAOs. It was right directionally. It showed a really clear vision, but it had some technical and legal issues. And what we're doing with Allow is squaring that with US law so that we can begin to experiment with it in Folsom and continue to build out the tooling that everybody's going to need so that we can bring this to more and more people around the globe over the next 5, 10, 15 years.
That's awesome. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I guess the main argument there is, as well, is that when someone signs up to a DAO, they automatically kind of take on some liability, right? Whether they want to or not. And so this is finding a way to kind of choose the right structure for DAOs so that they aren't inadvertently classified as partnerships and then have to deal with those responsibilities.
Exactly. So you can limit your liability. So that means if you have other assets at stake, so let's say you've been yield farming, you've collected a nice bag of coins. You don't want to put those at risk just because you're operating or interacting in a DAO. And if you're a more traditional enterprise, let's say you're an existing fund or a wealthy individual, you don't want to put your assets at stake just because you decided to participate in a DAO. So by wrapping it in a limited liability company, in the US, you're able to limit that liability. You're also able to clearly define what the relationships of the parties are. So in partnerships, each partner is a fiduciary to one another. That means they have to hold each other to higher standards. With an LLC, you can limit those fiduciary obligations to the extent provided by law, which is quite broad, which means that people can participate in a way I think is intended with the DAO, which is at arm's length, working together, maybe anonymously, maybe pseudonymously, maybe closely, maybe not closely, maybe passively, maybe actively. But you can begin to structure that and reflect that in a way that, you know, regulators, courts, or other bodies are able to understand and interpret it.
That's really interesting. And why did you choose a Delaware LLC? Because I remember there was an interesting reason for that, a sort of a legal technical reason for that.
Yeah. So in many parts of the globe, if you set up an organization, it has to have a manager. So in most of Europe, there needs to be a manager, somebody that's in charge of it. In the US, and I don't know if this is just a creature of the fact that we like democratic processes, we really give people a lot of freedom to contract with one another, and those contracts will be enforced. That's not a requirement here. So in the US, an LLC can be member managed. You don't need a board, you don't need a manager, you don't need somebody in charge. And you can pretty much define any rules that you want amongst those managers, and courts in the state in which you're chartered will enforce that. And so Delaware is just where most organizations are organized in the US, major organizations. So most S&P 500 traded companies are organized in Delaware. So we went to Delaware just because it's safe, predictable, understandable, and lots of folks know about it. Delaware, outside of Joe Biden, who's obviously going to take over in January, is really known for its corporate law and its corporate structures.
That's awesome. And this is probably not the right way to think about it, but I'm curious to get for you to correct me on it. So is there a sense in which integrating with the law in the way that open law does kind of limits the design space for what a DAO can do? Because I guess, you know, they take on some responsibilities and they have to comply with the law I guess the answer is that everyone does. But I guess with this, it's more kind of sort of overtly taking on those responsibilities. Is that a risk at all?
Yeah, it's a risk, but it's also an opportunity. I think if you look at industries and as they mature, usually the parties that dot I's and cross T's and do their best to comply with an existing legal structure or legal regime, they tend to win in the long run. So if you look at the exchange marketplace, think about Bitcoin exchanges from very early on, the folks that didn't dot I's, didn't cross T's, didn't comply with the law, they're not here with us. But at the same time, the Coinbases, the Geminis, the Krakens, they're building legitimate businesses that are growing quite large. Right? Coinbase is going to be going public in a couple of years. The same story played out with copyright, right? The last time we really grappled with widespread deployment of peer-to-peer technology, Napster doesn't exist, right? Nutella, nobody uses it that much. You know, BitTorrent never really built a viable business around it. But if you look at Spotify, which dotted I's and crossed T's, obtained formal licenses, it's a large publicly traded company. YouTube, which dotted I's and crossed T's when it came to protecting the rights of copyright owners, is a massive, massive company. So I think you're going to see parallel development where folks are going to experiment in different ways. They may not interact with the legal system, but in the long run, if that becomes large enough, that's going to create some issues. And if it creates issues, I think we're going to see the need to begin to organize it in a more formal way, in a way that complies with the law. And I think to Coinbase's credit and other folks that kind of compete with Coinbase in the US, they push regulators to evolve the law so that they can build the structures that they want, so that people can trade assets that they think should be traded. And I think we're kind of tilting in the right direction there. And because of that effort, that's why we have institutions that are thinking about digital assets. That's why we have, you know, lots of folks at a regulatory level looking for ways to accommodate the technology. And I think that that's overall a really important step. So I look forward to both, right? I look forward to what we're doing. I also look forward to seeing people experiment and push the envelope.
That's a great point. Yeah, a great point. That doesn't bode too well for, I guess, some of the innovation we're seeing in DeFi. Or what are your thoughts there? I guess CeFi is kind of the equivalent of the approach that you're taking, or in some ways, you know, leveraging kind of the crypto as a better technology, but still sort of complying with the law and integrating with traditional systems. And then like the more crypto native stuff, I guess, is, or at least what some of DeFi sits in, would you say?
Yeah, well, I think DeFi is a little bit different because at their at its core, most DeFi protocols are just trying to be automated software systems. So I think those that are developing those automated, you know, financial software systems shouldn't be held liable. But I'm sure that at some point in this, the DeFi stack that we're seeing emerge, whether or not that's with an aggregator, whether or not that's below some of these protocols at the pool level, there'll be some sort of regulatory response. I don't know exactly where that's going to hit yet. Absolutely. And maybe that forces or opens up an opportunity for CeFi. I'm a little less bullish on CeFi than I think others may be. There may be some other clever solutions or ways to accommodate the regulators' reasonable concerns.
That's cool. All right. So one of the first big use cases of open law was with the LAO. I guess, could you talk a little bit about what the LAO is and also why you chose kind of venture capital as the first use case? I guess it's something that already had some clear pent-up demand from kind of the DAO days.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think it really goes back to that story, right? I do think that the DAO was kind of the breakthrough first clear use case for Ethereum, and it animated a whole group of developers and other enthusiasts to really come to the Ethereum ecosystem. And so we saw that as something that's important and should be rebooted in some sort of way. There was also this notion, and Ryan Zur, who's one of the founding general partners at Polychain Capital, he made this point and it really resonated with me, which was if we had the DAO itself, a lot of the issues we saw with the token boom in 2016, 17, and 18 may not have come to fruition, right? If you had a group of people that were able to filter through the good projects and the bad projects and provide them capital so that they could continue to develop it, we may not have seen kind of the widespread issues that we saw with some of those earlier token-based experiments. So I thought that those two combinations, right? One is that this is something that should be built. There was clearly a demand for it. And two, this can actually solve some of the problems that we had in 2016, 17, and 18 that made it worthwhile to kind of reboot the DAO. And so we went through an inquiry and looked at all the laws that are in the US, and there's plenty of them, and kind of charted a path through them. And we decided to put it together. So we put together a limited liability company to wrap a DAO. So at its core, it does all the things that I mentioned before, limits liability, reduces fiduciary obligations amongst members, reduces potential conflicts of interest, denominates rights and obligations, clearly articulates what law is going to apply, accounts for dispute resolution, does all those things that you are going to want if you're running an organization at scale. And at the same time, it defers to software. So it says in the organizing documents that this organization is going to be run by code, primarily for its core aspects. So we put that together. We also worked with Amin Soleimani and the folks that put together MolekDAO to kind of evolve MolekDAO's smart contracts to begin to not just give grants, but actually take assets in as if you make an investment or support a project in some sort of way. So we went through that process. We got the smart contracts audited, and then we were ready to go. And on the open law side, we constructed this in a way because we're able to automatically generate the legal agreements. We also built tooling so that we can automatically summon and create DAOs to begin to factory out a DAO ecosystem. So the LAO is, you can kind of view as the root DAO or the mother DAO. It launched in April. It's at this point raised about $7+ million in Ether, and we backed 30 plus projects. And from that, we've begun a process of building out a network of DAOs that use the same core open law stack. The second DAO that we launched is what you can view as an NFT collective called Flamingo DAO. We're launching at the beginning of 2021 a liquidity DAO. And we're also going to be rolling out a DAO that's focused on personal social community tokens. So we're building out a whole ecosystem of these DAOs. They all kind of root back and roll back up into the LAO itself. And what's really interesting about the LAO is our hypothesis was that particularly in the crypto space, this kind of hive mind approach to identifying projects and opportunities and thinking through them and sorting through them and backing them would work really well in the Ethereum ecosystem. Because information is so disparate, there's so many people working on it from around the globe, different time zones. It's sometimes hard to know if there was there's an issue with the underlying smart contracts or if the technical team is good, and that's hard even for traditional venture capitalists. So in the LAO itself, we have 57 members, and we've been able to move really quick. We've also been able to spot really fast a lot of the great projects that are emerging in the ecosystem. And then we give them capital, right? We give them ether, because that's what we settle all the investments in. And we've been able to really watch them grow and develop and continue to make an impact, which is really exciting.
Yeah, that's really awesome. And I'm curious, why did you choose to build on Moloch versus kind of some of the other alternatives out there, whether it's Aragon or DAO Stack?
Yeah, I mean, Aragon is tremendous, and the folks at DAO Stack have done tremendous work, but Moloch is beautiful in its simplicity. So a lot of the underlying smart contracts are just built in such a way that you have a high degree of assurance that it's going to be secure. You also know that if there's an evolution of the Ethereum network with ETH 2.0 or otherwise, that it probably will be able, due to that simplicity, to make the jump in evolution. And beyond that, I felt very confident, or more confident, that some of the security vulnerabilities that we saw with the DAO itself were addressed by the Moloch design, right? So there was no loops, none of the vulnerabilities that I think caused the hack that we saw with the DAO were present with the Moloch smart contracts. So the work that the other DAO ecosystems are doing is awesome. We think it's amazing. We love to work with those folks to the extent possible. But I do think that kind of Moloch is the future here. And I do think we're going to get to a point shortly, and we've been working hard to get to this point, where DAO-based smart contracts are effectively ERC-20, ERC-721-like standards, where people can just pull them off the shelf. And you can see a whole ecosystem emerge around it, not just kind of dedicated platforms.
Yeah, that makes sense. And other than DAOs, with OpenLaw, you're also doing a lot of work in kind of legal wrapping smart contracts, I guess. And one of those is the work you're doing on delegated credit with Aave, who's also one of our partners. I'm curious, how does that work?
Yeah, so you know, the cypherpunks that came up with Bitcoin and came up with Ethereum, there was also a related concept that was kind of floating around the cypherpunk community since the 1990s. So the notion of, you know, e-money, digital currency, that's stuff that Hal Finney, Nick Szabo, Wei Dai, a whole bunch of other folks were thinking about for years. But at the same time, thinkers like Mark Miller and Ian Grigg and a whole bunch of others, and Nick Szabo, they were thinking about smart contracts and also a related concept called the Ricardian contract. And so the notion was, like, a smart contract's great to define rules, to set up what's in effect, kind of digital property rights, to move around assets. And that can be great and really important. But at the same time, there's other things that contracts do. They manage risk. They account for dispute resolution. They are a little bit more forward-looking in terms of providing representations and warranties of different sorts. And that was going to be really hard to memorialize using software, just a smart contract. And so this notion of a Ricardian contract was taking the best parts of what we have in traditional contracting and blending it together with the cryptographic systems of a blockchain and also smart contracts. And so that's what we set out to build. So we figured that somebody was going to build this, particularly early on in the Ethereum ecosystem. There was a handful of teams that did great work and made great strides to build this. So like the folks at Monax, the Materium folks, we've just built the most robust system to accomplish that task. And so what that means is, if you have any smart contract-based DeFi platform or other platform, as that platform grows and as it matures and as you want to kind of have that platform and protocol interact with the real world, OpenLaw is a great tool to do that. And that's what we did with Aave. So as Aave's grown, they've thought about not just over-collateralized loans, but under-collateralized loans. But one way to get to an under-collateralized loan is to actually have an agreement in place. So if somebody doesn't pay, and if somebody's unwilling to pay, if they default in some sort of way, you're able to go into a court and remedy that dispute and get damages. And really the only way that we have to do that now, we may have different ways in the future, but as of right now, is a legal agreement of some sort. And so we worked with the team. It was super easy. I think it took, I don't know, like 2 to 3 days. And we helped them build this, you know, delegated credit system that they want to roll out, which is really awesome.
And how does that work? For instance, if I take out a loan and I default, how does enforcement actually happen? Is the lender himself suing me, or is it arbitration, or is it actually taken to court? What's the process there?
So I don't remember the exact details, so I don't want to say something that may not be accurate. But you know, the agreement will govern, right? So let's say it does provide for arbitration. Well, that means that could be a traditional arbitration forum or tribunal, or in that contract, you could clearly state that it can be done via a blockchain-based arbitration system, right? But the nice thing there is that you can define kind of the paths to kind of resolve a dispute. And those disputes don't matter until they do matter, right? Usually there's a happy path and people are happy and there's no issue. And you actually at that point don't even need the contract. People are just performing. But when something goes wrong, when something goes sideways, a legal agreement's kind of your way to mitigate those risks. And that becomes important. And it will become important because even though we're in kind of in a, we just passed DeFi summer and things are looking really strong in the blockchain and Ethereum ecosystems, I'm sure that won't always be the case. Something's going to pop, something's going to break. There's going to be some negative market activity. And people are going to turn on each other and try to recoup any losses that they had. And those that have agreements in place will be able to administer that more fairly, more efficiently. And my sense is going forward, that will continue to kind of get baked in, just like we see in contracts baked in to society, whether that's traditional or digital, since the beginning of time, really, since the age of Mesopotamia.
Yeah, that's super interesting. So you're kind of, I guess the open law, you're kind of bridging the traditional world with crypto. What do you see as the ultimate vision there? Are you going to continue to kind of build out these different organization types like the LAO and like Flamingo to kind of dog food your own tools? Or are you building out kind of more of a platform or like software as a service style business so that others can build this kind of stuff? Yeah, what's the vision there?
Yeah, the vision is that contracts are kind of like the dark matter of the commercial world. They exist everywhere. And when you get to a point where you have a standardized contract, we've seen very large marketplaces emerge on top of it. So if you think about the options market, people at this point don't trade contracts; they just trade the data points underneath it. If you think about the massive derivatives market, it's largely the same, although there's some paperwork that gets transmitted. So we think open law is a very broad, powerful technology. It's a little bit like a database, right? It can kind of go anywhere. There's a lot of use cases for it. And we're going to be pushing in any direction where we think that this is useful. We think in the longer arc, there's a tremendous amount of usefulness for having Ricardian contracts or open law-based contracts operating in the traditional world. But right now, we're very focused and always have been focused on the crypto ecosystem. So anybody can use open law's tooling. It's open source. It's all easily accessible to be plugged into dApps or other services, via APIs. We've incorporated different tooling, including being able to pull in data from oracles like Chainlink, being able to build basic workflows using all of open law's tools. And that just for what we're trying to do just puts us at a little bit of a competitive advantage. Where we're able to leverage this technology to do fun things like what we're doing with the DAO and the LAO and all these other DAOs that we're building. So I think we're just going to continue to build stuff that we think people are interested in using and continue to push forward the crypto ecosystem and hopefully in a responsible way. And over the longer run, we hope more and more businesses, organizations pick this up because we do think that having contracts digitally native is really important. And the reason we think that, and this is in part why I got into the blockchain ecosystem, is the great financial crisis of 2008. The issue wasn't just a central bank, right? The issue was nobody knew what the heck was in the contracts that they entered into. So they couldn't assess the risk. The contracts were, in flat files, Microsoft Word files that nobody could understand, nobody could analyze, nobody could interact with. If we had widespread Ricardian contracting systems at that point in time, and you could have really seen a different response. We probably would have known a lot more about what was going on with all these transactions, and a lot of people wouldn't have gotten hurt. And I think that's critically important, and I think it's a moral imperative that we improve how we contract with one another.
Yeah, that's super important work. And this is kind of a higher level one, but I'm curious, given your background, how you see sort of the future of the law in general in sort of like 20 or 40 years, if everything goes as you plan, how do you see all this work? Because it's always kind of struck me, I sort of briefly studied some law at university, and it always kind of struck me how when you read the law, it does read like somewhat like code, right? Like contract code. And in Latin countries, it's often referred to as the code, right? And it's kind of like some of the conditions are subjective, but some are clearly objective. And in a sense, like the court is like the subjective oracle that weighs in on the kind of the subjective parts. And then there's kind of parliament that's like troubleshooting and editing the code base, if that makes sense. But it always struck me as weird that like when I go to set up a company or make a contract, that I have to kind of pay a lawyer to do it from scratch. There's no kind of open source, and it's kind of quite inefficient. So I'm curious, like, do you have a vision for like the future of the legal system or a blockchain enabled legal system?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the direction, right? I think software, to quote Mark Andreessen, is eating the world, and I don't think the legal industry is any different. And that's a massive industry, so it's about a quarter of the size of the entire financial services industry. And it hasn't been updated since the 1980s. So the last time the legal industry adopted any meaningful technology, it was Microsoft Word. That was the big innovation because it reduced costs dramatically. But I think with, tooling that we're building and other folks are building kind of in a more Web 2 type way, we can begin to automate the creation of documents better. We've obviously seen electronic signatures spread in particular due to the pandemic and other issues that we're facing in 2020. But at the same time, we still don't have really great workflow tools. So tools to kind of marshal along the process of putting together these agreements. And outside of open law, there's no real tool that can link together an agreement with an Ethereum-based smart contract call. And that's important because once you have an agreement signed, and this is the really powerful thing about Ethereum, you can perform an obligation under the agreement. You can transfer assets. You can push that into escrow. You can render online dispute resolution systems using Ethereum. So kind of closely coupling a legal agreement with the underlying smart contracts is really important. So I think the long-term vision is this technology will continue to spread. Just like we have an internet of money or value, I think we're going to have an internet of agreements. And that's Vinay Gupta from Ethereum. He kind of had this notion, and I think he's right about it. And once you have that, and once contracts are like software, really, really interesting things can happen. All the key data related to those contracts could conceivably be publicly surfaced or portions of it. That means we have a real, real close view on the economy. So what actually has the most important information about the economy, it's probably contracts, and we don't do a great job tracking that. Let's say there was something like the financial crisis in 2008, and we needed to upgrade all the agreements because of some issue. Well, if it's all software, you can patch them, right? You can send an update and
that's wild, amend all those
agreements. Let's say you're a law firm and you update your agreement because there's a change in the law, you realize that there was an issue in one of the provisions that you put together, you could push that to all your clients automatically. So if we can actually view contracts as these dynamic living systems instead of these dead, flat objects, I just think that will do a world of difference, will make commercial activity much more streamlined, improve the lives of people, lower the cost, and also make the practice of law better. And I do think that it's a huge, huge market. And really, the most innovative legal tech that we have out there right now is DocuSign, which records a hash on a PDF. So I think it's pretty ripe for transformation.
Yeah, that's incredibly interesting. And I mean, I think the criticism that people have of this kind of vision and of security tokens and of like off-chain assets being on-chain is that ultimately, like for off-chain assets, settlement happens off-chain. Even if I own the security or whatever, like the shares are still on a share register that's off-chain. But I think what's so powerful about what you're doing is if off-chain settlement becomes credible, then most contracts will just settle normally, right? It's a small percentage of contracts that have any problems, and then Ethereum could act as sort of this settlement layer.
Yeah, I think there's two things that are going to happen. There's going to be more bespoke agreements that will really use some of the tooling that we put together, and we make that easier to do. At the same time, and I think we're seeing this with DeFi more broadly, you know, a smart contract-based system, some sort of DeFi protocol, it really is just a deal. It's kind of like a contractual deal. I do think we're going to see governance tokens kind of spread in these ecosystems to manage the risk related to that deal. So instead of having it in the contract, it's going to get managed kind of collectively with a governance token. But at the same time, and this is why we think the work that we've done with Aave is important, to extend those protocols to other deals or more complexity, you're going to need some sort of legal agreement to float. Or even if you want to, you know, not really put together a more complex transaction that has a legal agreement, you may want to have something in place that can lay the foundation for, you know, some sort of online dispute resolution. And that's something that folks have talked about, but in many ways, the power of Ethereum hasn't been fully expressed, which is, you know, Ethereum is wildly disruptive to the judicial system for the simple fact that Ethereum and or smart contracts can enforce the decision of an arbitrator. So the only way that you can do that today is to go into a court, get a judgment, and have a court enforce that judgment. With Ethereum, you can, you know, put assets into a smart contract-based multisig or escrow-like relationship. You can have an arbitrator resolve a dispute and settle the judgment. That's a really big deal. And that really, really streamlines things dramatically. So I think we're just kind of scratching the surface on which way things will go. My sense is in the longer run, for particularly hyper-commoditized transactions, particularly financial relationships and transactions, you may not need a wrapper like OpenLaw, but for more bespoke things, more complex things, things that want to pool capital, et cetera, you're probably at some point, maybe it's at the top, but you're going to have some sort of legal documentation defining rights, obligations, and dispute resolution procedures.
Yeah, and for that to happen, for Ethereum to be able to enforce the smart contract judgments, the kind of the assets, like the Ethereum version of the assets, have to be recognized as legal, like, you know, sort of legal property rights to that asset, right? Because otherwise, you always need the off-chain settlement part.
Somewhat, right? In the U.S., they are legally recognized, right? We have a pretty, at least in the U.S., we have a pretty clear pulse on what these digital assets are, how some of them are going to be classified, how they're going to be taxed. So they're recognized, right? Wyoming, as an example, expressly provides that, you know, certain activities can occur via digital assets. You know, they can be custodied. This is what it means to effectively own them. So those types of questions have been resolved, and I think they're going to only get clarified over the next 5+ years.
That's really interesting. And how do you see like law firms in this new world? Are they becoming kind of software as a service companies specializing in particular types of contracts and having, like, you know, an easy template and then providing consulting on top of that? Or
I mean, that's what they do now, right? If you let's look at it like an emerging company's practice in a major law firm, they have a set of documents that have been standardized by the National Venture Capital Association. They basically pull those together using templates. They make a couple customized tweaks to them in most instances, if it's not a particularly complex deal. And then they provide services, right? They consult and tell a project or a fund, you know, how to get this done. So they kind of work them through that workflow, and they're effectively project managers through that process. So that's how the legal industry works right now. It's just hyper inefficient. And I'll give you an example. So we've been working with some of the state legislators in Wyoming to put together a bill that would formally legally recognize in the U.S. a DAO. So you'd be able to set up in Wyoming an entity with the appendage, you know, DAO as part of it. You'd enjoy limited liability. You'd be able to defer to the underlying software systems. You'd be able to limit fiduciary duties, do lots of the things that we've done and allow. But to set them up, you'd have to pay $75. And to set that up on the Ethereum side, you'd have to summon the smart contract. So that would cost a couple hundred dollars. So something today, like setting up a fund, which can cost upwards of $25,000, $50,000, $100,000, we can get to a point where that costs $75 to do that.
I mean, yeah, that's incredible.
That's pretty dramatic, right? So if you're thinking about setting up these structures in 5 to 10 years, are you going to pay $100,000 to set up your fund, $25,000 to set up your fund, or are you going to pay $100?
Yeah, that's incredible. It reminds me of kind of another quote, you know, the future is already here. It's just not evenly distributed. You know, there's kind of all these pockets of the amount of stuff you can do with a DAO now, I think most people don't realize.
And the costs are going down, right? So we saw, you know, with the great work of Balancer, being able to use, you know, through Snapshot and some other tools, being able to kind of handle governance votes at a much, much lower cost. But what we're working on the open law side is also being able to move assets at a much, much lower cost. So at some point in January, we're going to be releasing what we consider to be Moloch V3, and the Moloch community can adopt it or not. But with it, you'll have, you know, no cost governance voting. So if an organization needs to make some sort of decision, you can record that and move forward and have a record of that. But at the same time, if you want to move around assets, you won't have to spend hundreds of dollars in gas to do that. So even in the DAO ecosystem, the costs are going down. And that's why, and I know we've talked about this for quite some time in the Ethereum community, DAOs are coming, right? They're just a year or so behind where DeFi is. And this year we've seen, I think, the DAO ecosystem grow from about $10 million under management to over $330 million. And I wouldn't be surprised if at this point next year, it's multi-billion dollars, right? And we start to see kind of that hockey stick-like growth like we saw with DeFi.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then we've pulled a lot on your kind of legal background and also on your history background. I'm curious, putting your economist hat on, what's your mental model for kind of valuing both, I guess, two-part question, both the governance tools that you're building and that folks like Aragon and DAOStack are building? Because a lot of people seem to see these as kind of an open source library to import rather than a product that to pay for. And then I guess secondly, kind of governance itself. So these governance tokens and tokens that give you the right to exert influence on some underlying public good. How do you see the sort of value accrual for both of those?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think lots of folks are puzzling over that. And even though I studied economics, I'm definitely not an economist. But I do think increasingly governance tokens are important. I kind of view them as shelling points, so points of coordination for communities. And I think in open source ecosystems, we're going to see a lot of competition. I think we're already seeing this with DEXs, whereby you pretty much have the same product that's implemented under a different brand. So what's going to differentiate one community from another? I think it's going to be the community itself and how it's governed. And governance has a premium. Even if you look at traditional corporations, and folks have tried to quantify this, they've indicated that in a stock which has both economic rights and governance rights, you know, the governance rights account for 25% of the stock's value. So I think that governance tokens are important as kind of just a way to indicate to the public in a really easy to comprehend way the value of the community and how safe and secure it is. So if you were going to look at a DEX that looked a lot like Uniswap, you're probably going to try to get a sense of where should I implement a trade? Well, am I going to do it on this newer system that has a governance token that's trading at a lower value? Or am I going to do it on the largest, most prominent one that has a governance token trading at a higher value? And so I think the fact that these tokens exist and the fact that they may indicate kind of community support or maturity or risk management, I think ultimately is what the value may be. I increasingly think across the entire blockchain ecosystem that thinking about streams of payment or fees or royalties, if it's NFTs or personal tokens or social tokens, I just think that is legacy thinking. I think we're moving to a kind of a post-royalty world where we can get pretty fair, efficient pricing from markets. And that is valuable in and of itself. So just having a free floating price for a shelling point is valuable and something that will continue to be valuable. So I think to your question about these DAO projects and ecosystems, I do think if there is core infrastructure that is community managed and community supported, and because so many different projects will be relying on this technology, they're going to need a way to know whether or not the underlying tech is reliable, it's useful, it's going to be there for a while, You know, if you're a DeFi protocol and you're building a DAO, you're running a core aspect of what you're doing through these organizations, you probably want to say in how that operates. And if that rolls up into a governance token over that underlying software, I think that in and of itself will be pretty valuable.
Yeah, I mean, you definitely helped push my thinking forward on this. I remember when we initially spoke, I think a lot of people, us included, come at this with our finance hats on, and we see these DAOs as sort of companies. And so governance is valuable to the extent that sort of underlying thing being governed generates defensible cash flows, you know, and it's bears some relation to the discounted value of its future cash flows. But I think what kind of started changing my mind on this is realizing that there's a lot of these DAOs are governing sort of ecosystem-wide public goods that, while they don't have cash flows themselves, they do affect like the underlying cash flows of things that depend on them, you know. And I think there's a lot of examples for things in the real world that we can think would be valuable to govern even absent any cash flows, right? Like, for instance, determining the Facebook content algorithm or the Twitter algorithm would be valuable even if they didn't charge, even if they didn't have advertising, you know. And kind of, there are proxies for it in the real world. Like, you can look at the amount that people spend on fundraising for Senate seats, right? But I think these public goods have to be thought of differently because of like the role they play for other projects that depend on them. And that's where you arrive at this vision of like governance being valuable, I think, in and of itself, especially when it's a really important kind of ecosystem-wide public good.
Yeah. So maybe I can simplify it a bit, but
yeah.
Let's say that you had the ability to govern Silicon Valley, right? You had a seat at the table to determine how all of Silicon Valley would operate. My sense is that would be incredibly valuable. So if there's going to be, you know, DAO infrastructure, and if you're able to govern how that grows, develops, evolves, and that may not just impact funds like venture capital funds, but all fund structures, I just don't see how that isn't probably valuable in the long run, assuming that this vision continues to grow, right? So right now we have, you know, hundreds of DAOs that are managing millions of dollars worth of digital assets with tens of thousands of people interacting with it. But let's assume that there's going to be hyperbolic growth over the next 5 to 10 years. And there's lots of indications to indicate that is the case, right? So now you have tens of thousands of organizations, hundreds of thousands of organizations moving around billions upon billions of dollars worth of assets. You know, if you have a seat at the table to decide how that grows, that evolves, and can weigh in and govern that ecosystem or those ecosystems, I have to imagine that that has some sort of value. And the fact that we're able to get somewhat efficient pricing with blockchain technology on Ethereum, I think that that's something that we can actually now for the first time begin to value, right? And the more mature the marketplaces become as DeFi continues to grow, as people have the ability to short assets and go long on assets and trade them, and as liquidity improves, I just think we're going to get fair value and fair valuations. So maybe right now some of the early DeFi projects and their governance tokens are overvalued, but in the long run, if this continues to mature, if the market infrastructure continues to mature, and if this continues to grow, I just think that these governance tokens have independent value. And I think it roots in the same conversations that people are starting to have around personal tokens as well. I think it's the same logic. We're kind of quantifying these important networks, these public goods, these micro networks, if it's an individual, and rolling it all up into a token that really just represents a shelling point, a point for people to coordinate around.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And it certainly gave me a lot to think about when you first mentioned this to me. So I think our listeners will enjoy it as well. And then just last question, what are you most excited about that's happening in the DAO space?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the stuff that we're building with the LAO, we're super excited about. So like I noted before, we have two DAOs already. And what was amazing about it was that the second DAO, Flamingo, was kind of incubated and formulated by the members of the LAO. So I think it's really interesting that a DAO can not only efficiently identify projects and kind of sift through the massive information in the Ethereum ecosystem, but also think about the future and where opportunities may emerge. So that organic process is super exciting. And that's just the beginning. You know, by this time next year, I think you'll see 10 plus DAOs that are all kind of this part of this core LAO network, which we think is pretty cool. Secondarily, we're super excited about the technical improvements that are coming to DAOs. So being able to have low-cost governance voting and low-cost transferring of assets is really important. That means that a whole bunch of these newer DAO projects can begin to emerge. So we think that that's really important. And I think those are the two things that we're most excited about. I think more broadly, it's kind of this interaction that we're seeing on Ethereum. Like Ethereum has kind of three simultaneous growth curves in my mind. There's DeFi, which is kind of starting to express itself. There's DAOs, which are coming, you know, from behind. They're probably like 18 months behind. We're seeing NFTs, which I think are kind of growing really fast. And what's important there is that it's kind of the future blueprint for all of property, not just digital art. I think people are kind of under appreciating what we're doing there. I think we're kind of modeling out digital property rights for the first time. And then the last is, you know, these personal social tokens. So I think the interactions that DAOs will have with DeFi, with NFTs, with personal social community tokens is really, really interesting. And I think if we had a conversation in 10 years, you'll start to see it kind of all assemble like some sort of Voltron, some sort of crazy self-assembling organism. And that's pretty fun to watch and great to be a part of.
Yeah, that's an awesome vision. And I really appreciate your time. This was a real DAO masterclass. We definitely need to have you back on the Delphi podcast at some point to discuss maybe when your next DAO launches or when the Liquidity DAO launches. Those all sound really interesting. But I really appreciate your time today and sharing your knowledge.
Yeah, thanks so much. Really appreciate it, Jose.
Thank you.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you enjoyed it, please support the show by hitting subscribe on iTunes, writing a review, or sharing this episode on Twitter and LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our next episode out soon.